It's Wednesday, November the 10th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. I am delighted to be joined today by our London editor, Dennis Staunton, who's in Glasgow to cover the ongoing, continuing and seemingly never-ending COP26 summit. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Hugh.
We're going to be discussing the summit a little bit later and also its various implications for all of us into the future. But I should say now that I'm equally delighted to be joined by our political editor, Pat Leahy. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Hugh.
First of all, we're going to discuss the threatened Article 16 introduction by the British government, Dennis, because it's all over the front of the Irish Times today. There's a lot of concern expressed about it, but you have hot news from the House of Lords.
David Frost has just been on his feet in the House of Lords. We're talking at lunchtime on Wednesday, and so he's just in the last half hour sat down, and he was making a statement about the negotiations and how they're going. He does this every so often to the Lords, and then a similar statement is read out in the House of Commons. And basically what he was saying was that the negotiations are continuing, that they are getting a little closer together, but that they haven't reached agreement as yet on anything, really, but that they're making more progress in some areas than others. But also, crucially, he said that he thinks that there's some time left in the negotiations, so that he's not going to bring them to an end now. He thinks there are a small number of weeks left where they can continue. And this is significant for a couple of reasons. One is that when this began, this process began, he suggested that 3 weeks ought to be enough for it. And so the expectation was that this 3 weeks that we've just had, that might be it. Nobody expected Article 16 to be triggered while the COP26 conference was going on, for obvious reasons. But then the expectation over the last couple of weeks has been that it might be, you know, that it might be happening next week or the week after. And he seems to have withdrawn that. So he hasn't withdrawn the threat of Article 16. He, in fact, said that if things don't reach an agreement, that is the option available. And then he pushed back and hit back against the Europeans for threatening all kinds of terrible things if Britain did trigger Article 16.
Yeah, and we might come to that in a moment. But just to be clear on that, the increasingly loud noises that Article 16 was going to be implemented, where did they come from? Was there spinning going on in the background? I remember reading something about how the UK government was looking for alternative legal advice. There were various things going on, messages being sent that it was on the way.
Yeah, and I think that so you had all of those messages that are being sent, or at least, you know, those stories that they were getting alternative legal advice. David Frost confirmed that today in the House of Lords. But then you've also had, just from within government, everybody you spoke to who was connected with this process would say, yes, it was likely. And that's partly because some of the demands that Britain has, say, on removing the role of the European Court of Justice from the protocol, that those are obviously not going to be acceded to by the Europeans. So that there was very little confidence that the process in these few weeks was going to get there. And then, so the idea was that that Article 16 would be triggered. And then what you were getting, and again speaking to people around the process in Westminster and Whitehall, what they would talk about was triggering Article 16 in a calibrated and forensic way. Which is kind of the new version of limited and specific, which you remember from Brandon Lewis and the Internal Market Bill, where he was going to break the law in that way. So that, in other words, it was going to be a targeted use of Article 16. And nobody knew exactly what that meant, but that somehow they weren't going to kind of sweep everything away, but just that they would do it. And of course, if you do that, what you're really trying to do is to shift into a new phase of negotiations in a slightly heightened atmosphere.
Pat, what do you make of this announcement today?
Yeah, I must say I'm slightly surprised at it. And I'm slightly surprised at it because, just like Dennis, everybody you spoke to, whether they were on the British government side of things or whether they were in Brussels or whether they were in Dublin in recent days about this, has expected the British to trigger Article 16 imminently. In fact, there was a scare ran around Dublin last week that they were going to do it then, before the COP26 conference had finished at all. That proved not to be the case, but it was pretty much expected that it would happen as soon as COP26 was finished. Now, from what Dennis says, it appears that the British are stepping back a little bit from that. And I think that will be greeted by some surprise in Dublin and Brussels. But on first glance, it does seem that there is something for both sides to take out of this. The EU can say, oh, well, look, the British are listening to our warnings of immediate and terrible war. But the UK side can also say, well, you know, our threats are producing some results. There was the package of concessions or suggestions from Mara Sefcovic, which the British side continue to evaluate, and which one Irish official said to me about them that the British continue to turn these down. They really are refusing to take yes for an answer. So I don't think this is a resolution, but it is, I suppose, an important development and something that, as I say, both sides seem to have something to take from.
Dennis, what are we to make of all this? I mean, lots of commentators, including Pat in his Saturday column, have, you know, cast aspersions on, I suppose, the good faith of the British government in this matter, from the initial agreement of the Northern Ireland Protocol through this process, through the reaction to what were real concessions from the EU side in the negotiations over the last few months, where the tactical approach or strategic approach seemed to be always be, we'll take it, but we want a lot more. And then focusing in on something like the role of the European Court of Justice, which, whatever one's view on it, on the validity of that argument, is not really troubling civil society in Northern Ireland the way that arguably some of the other things about checks and balances at the ports are. So what is underlying the strategy which is being pursued by the British government on this issue over the last year now?
Well, I think I'll go back not quite for a year, but I'll go back to July, which was when they published the command paper outlining the new proposals that Britain had for essentially for renegotiating the protocol. And in those, in that command paper, David Frost said, we believe that the conditions are there for us to be legally justified in triggering Article 16. But he said, of course, the thing is that Article 16 only does a certain amount, and so it doesn't really solve the problem. There's a limit to what you can do under Article 16. So for now, we're not going to do that, and we want to have these negotiations, and we hope that the Europeans will respond. And what they wanted was a couple of things. One thing they wanted was a standstill, which was that everything remains the same, so that all the kind of the grace periods would remain in place, but also that the Europeans would pause their legal action against Britain. And so the Europeans did that. And then they wanted the Europeans to come up with some kind of proposals. And then in October, the European Union did come up with this set of proposals about the trade flows and making that a much, much, much easier. And that was much more generous, it appeared, than most people expected. And that came at the end of a process which had involved the Irish government and the unionist parties in Northern Ireland and the other parties in Northern Ireland. And essentially what the Irish had said to the Europeans was, the unionists need a political win. And so when this deal was being proposed by Sefcovic, it was very much framed as being for the people of Northern Ireland, not a prize for Boris Johnson. So this did appear to give them a win. But then, just before it was published, when it was clear how big and how generous it was going to be, then David Frost went to Lisbon and he made a speech where he stepped all over it. And he said, actually, what's really important to us is the European Court of Justice. And that also stepped over the win for the European, for the unionists, because they couldn't be less interested in the sovereignty of Northern Ireland than the British government. So the unionist leaders had to kind of go along with this, even though none of them had ever raised the issue. So what was the purpose of the threat of triggering Article 16? The purpose of that was that you would move the thing onto a new level of negotiations, because what Article 16 does is, the first thing it does is that it creates a period of, a further period of a month of negotiations. And then even if the thing is triggered and it's already there, then the idea would be there'd be a heightened atmosphere. But what changed in all of this was that David Frost, I think, left it too late. Had he done it, actually, in the summer, the shock value would still have been there. The Europeans hadn't really got their act together in terms of how they were going to respond to it. And so what's happened in the meantime is that the Europeans have decided that we've made this enormously generous offer. This is actually pushing to the limit, and some member states would say beyond the limit of what our generosity should allow. And yet, they're coming back and, as Pat says, they're not taking yes for an answer. And so in those circumstances, what are we going to do? We can't just allow them to continue to carry on in this way. So it must be made clear, if you trigger Article 16, two things. One is, all this calibrated and forensic, you can keep it. We don't care. That basically is the same thing. If you trigger Article 16, you're pressing the nuclear button. And you know what? We'll press a nuclear button over here too. And then you got briefings from a number of member states, particularly from the French, talking about, you know, kind of laying on the table what some of these weapons might be, including the termination of the trade and cooperation agreement, the complete termination of it, which it takes, you give 12 months notice to do it. But also in the meantime, maybe a few other immediate sanctions. And of course, you had a little prelude to what this might be like when the French in their fisheries dispute were talking about the various ways in which they could make life difficult for Britain, just by adding a few extra checks or being a bit more diligent in checks on the trucks going across to Calais. And you remember a year ago when there were trucks queuing up in Kent, it only took about 3 days before the whole country here went crazy about it. So in that sense, the Europeans laid out the fact that they are thinking about a much more aggressive response if Britain does that. That changed the calculation. And so what David Frost appears to have done now is to say, well, we may still do this, but right now it's in our interest just to step back for a moment and see where this thing goes.
And I'll come to, back to you in a sec, Pat, but could I just follow up with that, Dennis, and ask you, was it then, do you think, the British government anticipated that if they triggered Article 16, that, as you say, essentially there's a year's grace period for those negotiations to take place? So in terms of the overall trade agreement with the EU and the UK would not be affected. And I saw an analysis somewhere which suggested that the UK government expected that over the course of that period, they would demonstrate through facts on the ground, actually, that you didn't need all this falderal of the Northern Ireland Protocol, or at least in its complex current existence. And you had already proved their case, essentially, and that therefore they would win on that basis. But that's in the expectation that the EU would just sit there fairly emolliently, as it has done, I would say, pretty much for the last couple of years.
Exactly. And I think the point is it's a rational calculation, because basically every time that Britain has committed some atrocity in terms of the negotiations, what Europe has done is to send a solicitor's letter. And then most recently say, well, actually, we won't bother sending the follow-up, the final warning, and so we keep everything on pause. So the European response has been so gentle until now that the fact that the mood has changed, and the mood has changed in so many ways in Europe. So the fact is, like, obviously you always had the French being quite hardline, the Dutch, despite being traditionally friends of Britain, the Belgians, it was interesting that you saw, say, the two countries most exposed to any collapse of the trade deal, Belgium and Ireland, being out in the forefront of the last couple of weeks in saying that this is a real possibility. And then the other thing that has happened in the last month or so is that Italy has moved into the camp of the hawks on this issue. And so the Italian ambassador to the European Union spoke up in Coreper a few weeks ago, siding with those that are saying, there's a limit to what we can put up with. The new German government is likely to be in place sooner rather than later. That also was not what the British were calculating. They thought that Angela Merkel would still be in place. And of course, Angela Merkel, insofar as she is interested in doing anything before she goes in Europe, it's avoiding some huge standoff with Poland and Hungary. So that, so all of these calculations have changed. And so I think that as you say, they reasonably calculated that you could do this, you could keep pushing. And also they did congratulate themselves, as Pat was saying, like when the Europeans came up with this generous offer in October. The British, by the way, say it's not as generous as it looks, but still they came up with this offer. And the British government certainly did feel that this was David Frost's tough negotiating tactics bearing fruit. So we just have to see where it goes now.
I wonder then, Pat, what that says about the EU tactics over the last several months, whether they maybe gave too much license for the UK government to think that way, to think that it could get more by pushing more hard, and then might have been better off pursuing a harder line earlier in the negotiations. And I suppose the other question is, this is in reaction to the threat of Article 16 at this moment in time, but is this new harder line EU position, which Dennis describes across a number of countries, is that now the new position for the foreseeable future going onwards?
I think the EU position is it wants to come to some arrangement on the protocol. That's certainly very strongly the Irish position. I mean, you can imagine if the EU took what Dennis correctly refers to as the nuclear option and took a decision either at the December Council or at an emergency council, which would be required, takes a decision to serve notice, 12 months notice, that it's going to walk away from the trade and cooperation deal, then that would put Ireland into that position where it is once again caught in the sort of doomsday clock countdown to a no deal Brexit, where Ireland is put in the position of having to choose between border checks between the island of Ireland and the rest of the EU or border checks on the border. And, you know, we know how that played out the last time. Now, that was averted by, ultimately, by the British government blinking and agreeing to the protocol. It now, of course, wants to, you know, wants to go back and unpick that. But I think Dublin would be very reluctant to back a very hardline strategy, notwithstanding the fact that it can see results perhaps coming from this threat today. I think what the move does...
But isn't the case... Sorry, Pat. Isn't it the case, though, that what Dennis described, the previous policy was largely driven by the Irish government seeking to give a win to the unionist parties in Northern Ireland in particular, and framing the Sefcovic proposals very much in that light. And that, it's clear, didn't work, wasn't sufficient.
If that was the strategy, then it was probably ill-chosen, because the unionist parties cannot accept a win if the British government says that it's a defeat. Now, you might have thought...
But as Dennis says, the reason why they did that was because the British government then turned around and described it as a defeat, not because of anything happening in Belfast.
Yes, but ultimately the British writ runs in Belfast, not just legally, but also politically. Now, you could say that if there was more imagination and, you know, dare one say it, independence of thought in Stormont, that a way of pushing the British government into a better acceptance of the Sefcovic proposals would be a position taken by the Assembly, or a vote taken by the Assembly in favour of it. But there doesn't seem to be any... I mean, I've heard that suggestion made in Irish government circles, but it doesn't seem to be remotely near getting off the ground in Stormont. I think that one other thing that perhaps the move today may do is it fuels the impression in Dublin and in at least some of the EU that there isn't really a strategy at play in London. Or if there is a strategy, then it's a purely political one which seeks a kind of a constant low-level conflict between the EU and the UK. Now, you put that to British government sources and they absolutely hotly dispute both the fact of it and the analysis that lies behind it. But it is equally fervently believed in at least parts of Brussels and Dublin.
Yeah, what do you think of that, Dennis? I always think of Dominic Cummings' description of Boris Johnson as a supermarket trolley. In other words, something with no real mind of its own, wandering hither and thither, and who knows what it's going to do next because it has no guiding principles. And there does seem to be a bit of that about this. I mean, I was wondering if you played out the various scenarios, which lots of people have been doing over the last few days, they were all rather bad for the Tory government. You know, shortages in the run-up to Christmas, if things clogged up again at the borders, as you described earlier, or indeed back into a whole no deal clock ticking thing for the whole of next year, which again wouldn't be terribly attractive for a government which is allegedly thinking of having an election the following year.
Yeah, I think that's right. But certainly, I mean, you know, all of that is true about Boris Johnson, but other things are true as well, which is that he sometimes, his counterintuitive or, you know, his particular political instincts, even though most people think they're crazy, they sometimes work. And he is the central and the crucial figure here. You know, it is his decision. He is, as everybody keeps saying, the one who has been most hardline on it. But at the same time, he's also, one of his political gifts is that he will reverse very quickly when he has to, and you saw that in agreeing to the protocol in the first place. So I think, that's one thing. I think that, there is a potential strategy. There's an alternative, should we say. Like if David Frost and company have concluded that actually, as I believe, that the calculation that the move towards Article 16 was based on, that's changed now, and so that it wouldn't achieve what they want to do. Then the alternative, of course, is actually that you do slow everything down, and you actually do get to what Pat was talking about, this kind of frozen conflict where the thing is not resolved. So in other words, what you would do is that you would keep rejecting what the European Union is offering, but you don't actually trigger Article 16. You also then are creating facts on the ground, not in the dramatic way that you would if you imposed the command paper, but just by virtue of the fact that right now the protocol is not being implemented in full. So it's going to be quite hard to say in a year's time, after it's been running like this for 2 years, that the single market is at enormous risk, if there actually has been no apparent risk of the single market in running it this way. It's also a fact, I think, that it's much easier for the Europeans to get galvanized around a very robust response to the British doing something. But to the British not doing something, it's rather more difficult. So in other words, at what stage does somebody say in Brussels, hey, have you noticed it's now another few months and we really haven't got any resolution of this, and we still have all these grace periods going on and nothing's happening, so let's all impose sanctions on Britain. Well, I just don't think you're going to get that. So if I were advising the British government, which I thank the Lord I'm not, then I think I would say that actually go with what David Frost appears to be doing today. Step back and do very little. This was Helmut Kohl's principle of governing, which he called aussitzen, sit it out. And that's actually something which is often effective. And so I think that, you could actually create much bigger problems for the Europeans in the long run if you actually just do that. And then you wait for political circumstances perhaps to change in such a way that they would be more advantageous.
That makes a lot of sense, Pat, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does, however, though, also presuppose that the Johnson government is really agitated and outraged by the barriers to trade, such as they are, that the protocol entails between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom. That's not really something that is believed, certainly in Dublin and perhaps in parts of Brussels as well. The analysis of the Johnson government is that it is playing this for political gain, that it is not motivated by a deep concern for the union. And for that analysis, they rely on the recent observation of Boris Johnson's massive U-turn in agreeing the protocol in the first place. I mean, if somebody demonstrates through their actions that they don't really care about something, it's a bit harder to take their pleas afterwards that they are in fact in invested in it. I don't know personally. Dennis might have a better read into the internal thoughts of the British government, certainly, than I would. But I can tell you that is what is believed, certainly in large parts of the Irish government.
Well, I have no doubt that we're going to be continuing to discuss this. But stick with us for a moment, because we're going to take a break. But after that, we'll be back to discuss what's happening right now at COP26. And you're welcome back. Dennis and Pat are still with me. Dennis, as I said at the outset, you're in Glasgow. From a distance, it looks like a fairly remarkable media circus, and I find it difficult to discern exactly what's going on. Do you have a better idea that you can share with us?
Yeah, well, the COP sort of, it happens in kind of stages. So the first stage was last week when all the leaders arrived and they make their individual statements, and they agreed to a number of sort of high-level initiatives about forests, about electric vehicles, about various issues. And the idea being that you start the thing off with a bit of momentum and you say, right, this is where we want to go. And where they want to go is to keep the target of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade, to limit that, to keep that target alive. They're not expecting that all the commitments they make here are going to get them to there immediately, but they want to kind of, you know, to get themselves on the path to doing that. And so they wanted to get some concrete commitments. So then the leaders left, and then you had the technical negotiators who were doing a lot of the stuff, sort of officials. That was last week. And now you have ministers. So you'll have environment ministers, energy ministers, business ministers, all of these people. So it's moving back up into the political level. But at the same time, these talks are highly technical. Today, Boris Johnson has arrived. There are no other leaders for him to meet. They're very much gone. But he's basically saying, you know, we've got to kind of give this thing a bit of a push. And so the first draft of the of the final kind of deal was published this morning. And it does appear to be quite disappointing in terms of just not getting to, anywhere near where they want to go. But then it is a couple of days to go. So it's the kind of dismal kind of verdict that you normally get a couple of days before the end of one of these conferences.
So without being too cynical about it, it's kind of the natural rhythms of a 2-week negotiating process. It's all built into the calendars. You get some dramatic peaks and troughs before hopefully somebody emerges triumphantly clutching a piece of paper on Saturday evening or something.
Yeah, I think also that actually, there's a sort of an inbuilt probability of success here, because the final product is not supposed to be some grand unifying treaty. Essentially, what it is like this is a continuation of the Paris Climate Summit in 2015, where they agreed to do certain things. And so this is saying, how are we getting on? Can we, put a bit of reality on this, get some real targets, get some real plans, and then get a process. So, like, nobody thinks this is the last word, and they're all, and in fact, one of the things they probably will agree to is to meet either next year or the year after to have another one. And then to, so this is a kind of it's a process. So even if they don't actually, get, so it's not going to be one of these things where, like you often have, say, the World Trade Organization rounds. I remember being in Doha 20 years ago, actually, for the Doha trade round, which never got anywhere at all. But every time that they left with failure because they had failed to agree a deal. And so a bit like European summits, they can fail. But this one is one that, in a sense, it can't completely fail, and it's unlikely to completely succeed.
So this draft document, which you described, which was released, I think, today, it's a relatively short document. It's only about 7 pages or so. So it's obviously quite broad strokes. And most people have focused in on the fact that it asks countries to come back again quite soon, as you say, at the end of next year, with improved proposals or more ambitious proposals for getting to their targets. Is that maybe part of a change in the rhythms of this process? One of the things that strikes me about it is it's becoming more and more urgent. More and more people are aware of the potential disasters which are looming. So having these things every 5 or 6 years may not be sufficient to the task. We should be paying more attention to them.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think also the thing that the British government did in chairing these, generally speaking, what happens at the end of these conferences is that everybody, they all agree on goals and they share the same goal. And each country says, this is what we're going to do. But they don't actually, there's nothing really binding about it. And this stuff won't be binding either. But they also haven't been awfully specific before. Whereas this, an awful lot of countries now have come up with really very specific plans, rather like the plan that, we've come up with in Ireland, that actually these are actual real policies that have costs attached to them and that you actually have to do something about. Now, obviously, they may not succeed, but at least it's getting you more into the place. The problem, though, is that on the basis of the analysis that the experts have been given this week, this stuff will get to it. Like, what they've promised so far might get us down to 2.7 or 2.4. And we now know that even at 2 degrees, which was what the initial aim had been, sort of somewhere below 2 degrees, that actually all kinds of terrible things happen then. So that when, if you really don't get close to 2 degrees at the end of this week, you're really kind of giving yourself an awful lot of ground to make up over the next year or two.
How does this all intersect with, quite dramatic changes we've had in government policy in Ireland over the last year or so, Pat? Will it impact them further over the next year or two, the proposals coming out of Glasgow?
I think more important is the national plan in Ireland, which gives effect to reaching those targets as set down in Glasgow or as agreed in Glasgow. And the big difference, of course, is now that because of the climate legislation that was passed by the Oireachtas earlier this year, is that those are now legally binding targets for this government and the next government, unless it repeals the climate legislation, that it has to legally take steps to achieve. Now, achieving them, of course, is going to be extremely difficult. I mean, you look at like two of the big areas in home heating, which, you know, requires, you know, a massive retrofitting program, and transport, which aims to have 1 million electric vehicles on the road by 2030. I mean, immediately people have asked questions about, you know, the capacity to achieve the level of retrofitting and insulation and so forth that is required to cut emissions on home heating, and the capacity, not to mind the actual public will to buy electric vehicles and give up diesel and petrol vehicles, but whether those, you know, whether there will be the supply of electric vehicles, whether there will be the charging points to make them viable, and, you know, all those sort of, you know, practical capacity issues that I think the plan will run up against. That having been said, I think if they were to achieve most of their targets, or were to be on course to achieve most of their targets by the middle of the decade, I think the Green Party, which is the driver of all this, of course, in government, would be reasonably satisfied, notwithstanding the fact that many of its members and supporting NGOs might say we are not doing enough, but we will be doing vastly more than we are doing now.
You hear a lot of pushback in Ireland, Dennis, and I'm sure in lots of other countries too, and when these proposals are brought in by national governments at the national level, about how little impact little Ireland can have when, if China or India or Russia don't pull their weight, or if Bolsonaro doesn't stop what he's doing in Brazil, or whatever it might be. I mean, are there major recidivists whose lack of cooperation, I suppose, is going to have a major impact on the ability of us all to have any chance of meeting these targets? I mean, obviously, some of the leaders from those countries weren't there last week.
Yeah, there are remarkably few, like, full-blown recidivists or opponents of the whole thing. So, for example, if you look at China, the Chinese President Xi Jinping didn't travel to Glasgow, but he hasn't left China since before the pandemic began. And likewise, you know, China has been quite cautious in terms of making or joining in these very ambitious commitments. But at the same time, China is doing an awful lot itself, but it's doing it kind of on its own terms in terms of reducing emissions, chiefly for its own good reasons. You know, so I think that you find that, and then you also found that, say, countries like Indonesia and Brazil signing up to the deforestation agreement. Indonesia sort of wriggled a little bit, in the days afterwards. But you actually are finding countries that had traditionally been very reluctant to go anywhere near any of the measures required, that they're actually at least signing up to doing something, and they're not kind of, you know, completely rejecting them. So I think that and that's partly to do with what you were describing in terms of the mood changing, that in a way, this whole, you know, if we were talking even a couple of years ago, the whole business of the climate change deniers would still have been somewhere on the menu. Like, you don't hear about any of that anymore. You hear just about people being, you know, a bit reluctant to kind of do their bit. And so I think that's sort of where you are. So I think that it's not, you know, we're not in as bad a place as we would have been a couple of years ago.
I think there might be one or two climate change deniers still left in the seats of the Dáil from time to time, if I were to listen to what they're saying, Pat. I suppose, from an Irish perspective, finally, there is a way, isn't there, that these kinds of international agreements help a government in terms of giving them some cover, in the same way that successive Irish governments have been able to blame Brussels for introducing things that were good for us but that we didn't necessarily want.
Yeah, it gives them political cover, but only limited cover. And one of the things I think that will be interesting to watch is if there is a change in government after the next election. And, you know, if there is, perhaps some of it might come about because of the unpopularity of the present government, due in part, not in toto, but in part to some of the climate measures that they will have introduced by then. The carbon tax isn't particularly popular. Sinn Féin says there shouldn't be any increases in the carbon tax there. Most people's tip at this point to lead the next government. So I think that'll be one thing to watch. But I think the game changer for, I mean, I suppose there's two game changing aspects of it. One is the greater awareness of climate change amongst the public. Now, we shouldn't get carried away by this, and the public will be grumpy and perhaps unwilling to accept some climate measures. But there is a global movement. Ireland is not unique in this. There is a global movement of awareness and willingness, at least in part, to do something about climate change, notwithstanding the inconvenience or impoverishment, perhaps, that that may require for some people. The other thing is, I suppose, what I referred to earlier. It's the fact that these targets are now enshrined in law. So any future government must either break the law or change if it is not going to reach these targets. And that, I think, is probably the biggest achievement of the Green Party in government so far, and demonstrates, from a purely political perspective, the success of their participation in coalition up to this point, at least.
A last question on a different subject to you, Dennis, because it pertains to your regular stomping ground at Westminster, and that's the question of Tory sleaze. It's a hearty perennial in the British media, and it's reared its head again quite dramatically last week with a fairly incompetent attempt by Boris Johnson's government to protect one of his older friends, perhaps no longer a friend after what's happened over the last week or so. And then I see another story today about the Tory MP, Geoffrey Cox. So these questions of a party having been in power for too long, feathering its nest too much, they've been very potent in British politics in the past. Should we take them seriously now again?
I think we should take them seriously, partly because the interests of Conservative MPs and the interests of the public, or at least the prejudices of these two groups, are not aligned on this one. And Boris Johnson wants to please both of them. And so what you described was Boris Johnson trying to save Owen Paterson, former Northern Ireland Secretary, long-standing Brexiteer, from being censured by the House of Commons and suspended for 30 days because he had been taking £100,000 a year from two companies and asking various questions of ministers and arranging meetings and essentially breaking the rules. There was a great deal of sympathy for Owen Paterson because his wife took her own life last year. He connected her suicide with the pressure of this investigation. And so a lot of his friends in the Conservative Party wanted to save him. Boris Johnson made a mess of it. And not only did it mean that Owen Paterson has now resigned as an MP, but also all of the Conservative MPs, all MPs are now under scrutiny for their second jobs, for all of their, so journalists going through the register of members' interests, looking at everything that they've done, things that nobody cared about last year, they suddenly all care about now. Geoffrey Cox is a particularly high profile example because he's been making about £1 million a year, part of it by being in the Virgin Islands to do his work as a barrister. And so, but he's sounding quite defiant today. But the problem is that Boris Johnson has made life very difficult for Conservative MPs. And he can't really side with the MPs and say that everything is fine, the system as it is now is fine, if the public feel as if it's outrageous that people who are earning £82,000 a year feel as if that's not enough. But an awful lot of Conservative MPs feel as if it's not nearly enough to manage the lifestyle that they want. And so that's a conflict that Boris Johnson finds himself in the middle of.
And was Geoffrey Cox just working from home in the same way as many of us are? You know, to be honest, I'm speaking to you now from an idyllic small island in the Indian Ocean. I mean, was that just part of the rules as they proposed with remote working, or can an MP? Can MPs all work from the Caribbean, should they so wish?
It was kind of working from home, except that it wasn't really, because he was in the Virgin Islands and he was advising the government of the Virgin Islands, who were in a conflict with the British Foreign Office about whether the government of the Conservative Islands of the Virgin Islands was corrupt. And so he was down there doing his work for them for a large amount of money, and he was then proxy voting. They had this proxy voting system during the lockdowns. And so he said he cleared it all with the chief whip, and that he did nothing wrong. Something more dangerous to him has come to light there this morning, because the Times newspaper has found a video where he appeared to be appearing at a hearing in one of these cases from his House of Commons office. And that's absolutely against the rules. You could only use the House of Commons for your public business, not for any of your private business. And that's been referred to the Standards Commissioner. He says he'll abide by whatever decision comes out of that, but that he doesn't think he broke the rules.
Does any of this have any resonance for our own representatives more locally, Pat?
Not that I can immediately see. I just hope that Dennis doesn't use his House of Commons offices for any purposes other than those which they are.
I think I can speak for Dennis that he's perfectly satisfied with his excellent Irish Times salary and doesn't feel the need.
Absolutely right. Certainly right.
And that's true of all of us. And on that happy note, we will leave it there. Thanks very much to Dennis and Pat. Thanks to Declan Conlon, our producer. You can mail us with your thoughts and prayers at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. But until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.